Last week we tried to emphasize the various facilities that are available to help you gather a bibliography. This, of course, as you know, and I tried to bring it home last week, is a real concern when you bear in mind that according to a recent report by the Ford Foundation, Ford Foundation, indicating that the world's annual production of books is an estimated 320,000 separate titles a year. Annual production, 320,000, which means nearly 1,000 fresh works published every day. In addition, there are some 33,000 newspapers and 70,000 periodicals. Currently, there are 100,000 published scientific journal articles. And in medicine, it is estimated that some 200,000 journal articles and 10,000 monographs are published annually. So if you think that in theology there is a outpouring, that certainly is more true even in the other areas. This is one reason why libraries in the future will have to be thinking in terms of some computerized way of meeting the needs. Just is impossible. We're choking ourselves with words, papers. One thing you will be looking for, particularly if you're dealing with a doctorate, and that is trying to find out listings of abstracts or dissertations in your field. We talked about that, you remember. Again, there is no specific publication which will take care of all the needs. Some of the journals in limited areas, like biblical, will occasionally list the dissertations published in a given country. For instance, the doctoral dissertations in religious education are published annually by the National Council of Religious Christian Churches, and often is republished in the magazine, in fact, regularly republished in Religious Education, the magazine. I think it usually occurs in their May-June number. Yes, this particular one, you'll notice then that there are oftentimes, if you're in this area, something that will be of help to you and fresh off the griddle. This was 1956-57. I see one young geez worked out here, the concept of education in the light of the theology of Martin Luther. And if I remember correctly, there was another one in here by one of our men or by one of us from our school. I don't recall whether it's not important. But it does show the, here's one by one of our pastors, but not from here, Donald Justin Wolfram. His is the University of Denver. So much for dissertations, books, periodicals. Must say yet that another rich area to which you want to address yourself, if you are, I mean, this is part of the material, are the newspapers. There is a list called the Union List of Serials in Libraries in the United States and Canada. And we also have part of that in our library. And then the newspaper one, that's periodicals. Newspaper is called American Newspapers, 1821 to 1936. We do not have that. Washington University does have it. Again, if you want to know if you're dealing with a historical item taking place in this country, naturally you would like to see how it was reported in the newspapers of the day. and more likely to find material on related subjects in the older periodical papers than you would today. Simply, they were hungrier for news. Today, with our international communications, it has to be a very important thing if some local church or some pastor or some individual, especially in a larger city, had something newsworthy. The New York Times Index is a very, very important source if you're dealing with current items, and that index is also at Washington University. As you know, New York Times makes it a practice to publish in full all important documents, at least important as they see it, of the day. And so, for instance, encyclical letters, which you may have difficulty in finding, or biographies of important world figures, naturally all the political texts, agreements between nations, and oftentimes between larger church bodies, are printed in full. And the index, which is available at Washington University, would then become a very important source. Now that's from 1913 on. That's, of course, very recent, as history goes. Now, just a quick overview of the facilities that are here in the St. Louis area. And again, this is of only fringe interest to some of you. If you're in the biblical field, there's very little that you can get out of outside of one or two libraries beyond the seminary. But if you're in the history area, in some of the practical areas, why, almost all of these libraries will be of tremendous value. I think you are sufficiently aware of some of our collection I need not go into detail. Some of the very valuable things are still not cataloged. It's a long process. For instance, we have a collection of some 1,300 European dissertations, mostly out of the 17th and 18th century, which in themselves will someday, when there are indexed, will be tremendously valued. The Peasant War collection, which is probably one of the largest in the country, has just about finished, if it isn't already cataloged completely. All the official records of the church councils of the early church, the so-called Manzi collection, 53 volumes. We have that here. The only other library that does have it in this whole area is the St. Louis University Library, but they got a duplicate copy of ours. They had it microfilmed, or I don't know just what process. Washington University is particularly important in the field of classics. Now, only speaking of areas that would be related to what we're thinking of, American history, of course, British history, and then to some extent at least sociology. Now, of course, it has ample material in all the other areas also, but these are extraordinary. St. Louis University is particularly known for its Vatican Library, the only place outside of Vatican City where much of this material can be gotten. Our city library is important for its very large collection of general periodicals. Oftentimes, if you're using your international index and the reader's guide and pool and a number of the other indexes, we don't have the periodicals. By and large, you can, well, many of them over to Washington U, incidentally, also, but the very large collection downtown in the in the city library. Also, all important census reports are in the local library. It is the official, for this area, the official depository for the government documents, Supreme Court decisions, congressional hearing reports and the like, which can be very important to you if you're dealing with such problems of church and state and the school problems and many other things of a similar nature. And then I already indicated as a complete set of the New York Times Index, and has a complete set of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which is also one of the major newspapers of the country, but does not have the feature which the New York Times has in writing and giving you in full all the documents. Concordia Historical Institute is probably the largest single depository for American Lutheranism in this country. However, it does not limit itself to the Missouri Synod, although obviously the bulk of its collection is here. It has the archives of the Synod, for instance. It has a very outstanding microfilm collection of Lutheran periodicals. I don't know of another place in the country where there are as many copies of, available. In fact, this is made possible through a special grant of the Lutheran Layman's League, so it is a major strength. Just recently, they came out with their microfilm index, and this already gives you a picture of the bulk of the collection. When you think that every microfilm is covers hundreds and hundreds of pages, and then to have a book this size, merely an index, you know that this is one major source for any subject in the area of American Lutheranism. It has more than 2 million manuscript papers and some 38,000 books. And this, by the way, is over 100,000 feet of microfilm material available. The I could indicate that we have a little description of this in here. Let me see, that's on page 26 in your notes, which will give you a brief picture of some of the collections. And page 25 will give you a picture of the foundation. Here again, some million pages of manuscripts have already been microfilmed. Although it is much younger, so to speak, than the Historical Institute, it already has a microfilm collection which is larger than the CHI. Of course, this is the bulk of their work. This is where they are working practically exclusively. So obviously, you would expect them to deal with microfilm. Its area is primarily the 15th and 16th century Reformation, not only Lutheran Reformation, but Counter-Reformation and the Reformation of the minor groups, Anabaptists and the like. It, as your little description indicates, it has the political archives of Philip of Hesse, the Simmlersche Sammlung of Zurich, and I don't think it's described in that little on that page, but it has the complete works of Brentz, plus about 150 books about Brentz, so it's probably one of the largest collections in this country anyway, of that area. It has all of the major works of Bugenhagen, and that's some 50. So plenty of material for anyone who is dealing with that phase of the Reformation. Eden Seminary becomes another source, although a very modest one compared with those that I've mentioned so far. Their collection is considerably smaller than ours, less than half, although it's coming in with a new library, so I hope that it means that they're going to be able to expand. Its major strength lies in giving you the background material and the basic material for the Reformed Church in Europe and Asia. It has a very invaluable collection of Americana, which is background for the American church history, particularly for the German element. It serves as the archives for the Old Evangelical Synod of North America, a group that you'll have to consult about, if you are dealing with any phase of Missouri Synod history. Because as you know, particularly in this area, this was the number one rival to the Missouri Synod. And you can see that if you watch how the congregations are spotted. Take any of the older churches, the first 15 churches of the Missouri Synod in this city, and I venture to say within 3 to 5 blocks, there is a church which was originally Evangelical Synod. Holy Cross, Zion. There are two Zions. One is Missouri Synod, one is Evangelical. They even not only they split off, but they also often retain the name. Sometimes if it was Missouri Synod that split off, depending on who happened to have the most votes at the time, and then we set up one nearby because it was the area in which the people living, it would be natural that they put it there. Because this is today the Church of Christ, formerly the ENR. So you see there's such a close relationship between the two church bodies in this St. Louis area, not so much in other parts because this was the headquarters of both groups. And the Evangelical Synod, of course, never did grow very large. Eden Seminary is one of is the only seminary that it had, and was quite small until recently. Probably one more that I should mention, or maybe two more, but again, they deal primarily with American church history or American history, namely the Jefferson Memorial Museum. Very valuable, again, for background, especially journals, letters, and newspapers. Here's probably one of the few places where you can get some of the early papers of this area. And then the Mercantile Library, a private library in one of the bank buildings downtown, in fact it owns the bank building, organized prior to the city library. The merchants got together and founded this library in order to have the business and the economic records that the community needed for its work. And as a result, it is very strong in middle 19th century, early 20th century material. Very strong. Not only, as you would expect, in the mercantile area, like business, finance, and politics, but since it was the prominent library until fairly recently, until Carnegie Foundation got busy and gave money to the local library and got that started, many of the pastors of this area would donate their library to the mercantile. So they have a fairly good, limited, of course, library which deals with American Lutheranism, American Christianity. Very little on Lutheranism because, again, it didn't attract too much in that area. So much for local resources, and again, from maybe 50% of you or more, this is not very appropriate, and yet one should be ready to look into all the sources that are even remotely associated with one's topic. For your own information, when you're out in the field, I'm not going to give you the list of them because they vary and the rules change, but you should, when you get into a certain area like New England, especially out east, New York, Pennsylvania, and in the southeastern states, there are a number of theological lending libraries who, and this is merely for the angle of keeping abreast, who normally send you books, mail it to you, no cost involved for you, except the return postage. And sometimes a very small fee only to keep you posted in the new books that they are purchasing or getting. Many of them are associated with a seminary. For instance, in Boston, the General Theological Library has one. They'll send it to any minister in New England. Send books. They're usually circumscribed that way. Although the Congregational Library in Boston will send anywheres in the United States, regardless of the borrower's denomination or profession. And so one can go on. One of the larger ones for the South and Southwest is the Vanderbilt University of Religion. I know when I was in the parish, this is where I often got my books, from Vanderbilt. So they go into the entire South and Southwest. Now that's merely for future reference, or it may be valuable if you can't finish your work this year and have to go back into a parish or go into a parish. Then I don't know I need to tell you much about interloan library facilities. I think by now every one of you is acquainted with the facilities. If not, Mr. Nolan Bramer would be very happy to give you the information. And in fact, you give him the title and location, what library the book may be found in, and he'll take care of the rest of the problem. Also, with all the different types of photo duplication today, that you can get things microfilmed or Xeroxed. Now, Xerox, as you know, can be very expensive. For instance, in the Library of Congress, there is a minimum charge. I forgot what it is offhand. I think it's $3. And then it's about 28 cents, I think. No, 18 cents a page. North Carolina is 25 cents a page. New York Library, I think, is 28 cents a page, without a minimum. So you can count your blessings, get all you can before you leave the campus, because this is about the cheapest place that I know of. The minimum outside of the seminary, as far as I know, anywhere that I've run across, is 10 cents. And not too many are holding it at 10. But there are a number. I know this summer I went to two libraries and the prices were 10 there. But I also went to Washington and New York, and I found out to my consternation, I had already ordered the book, that a 60 pages of Xerox would cost me $16 plus a dollar service. But I didn't have the courage to say, no, I don't want it anymore. It was still worth it, but I did. It was a sort of a shocker after being spoiled by paying what we pay around here. You should know also that the Library of Congress will also make a photostatic copy of single pages, Xerox too, of course, now. And then you should know the facilities that many of the libraries have, and we have it here at the Historical Institute, and we have a limited service at the seminary. Our seminary one is not as good as the one at the Historical Institute. This is an area where 6 months after you buy it, the thing's obsolete. Some joker always comes up with a better machine, and that's the way it is now with the CHI and the seminary, where right off a microfilm, copies can be made. The one that we have at the library, and I think at the foundation, is good, except that the paper that is used is said to fade, after a while. I don't know how true that is. I had this one made about 6 or 8 years ago, and I don't think it's a bit darker than it was at that time. Maybe it's merely because you keep it in a book or in a little file and it's dark. I suppose in light it might fade faster. But the one that the seminary, CHI now has, is more or less permanent. Obviously, again, when you get it made like this, you can quickly transfer it to Xerox, and it stays more permanent. I think it's 25 cents a page for the one of the CHI. It's more work involved, and the machine is a little more costly, in the sense that you buy the machine, while the Xerox you cannot buy, you rent. And of course the cost is then spread over many years, and as a result, you're paying it. It's a built-in cost, but it gets to be very little per page. So these are two important areas, though, nevertheless, Library of Congress and the New York Public Library. And of course, there are very important areas outside of that, Chicago, the Philadelphia Free Library, and, you name it, you can get it. Now, any question at this moment in terms of getting sources, getting at the sources, getting material? Yes, sir?
I was wondering about the library.
Yeah, I should have included. I don't know much about it, frankly. Until recently, it was not even available, and that's, I haven't gotten, I may still not be available, but I didn't inquire recently. I would imagine, if it's open, it should be a very valuable source for material relating to the 1870 Council, at the time when they declared the infallibility, since Kendrick was a holdout on that one. And it must have some very valuable and interesting correspondence and writing and pamphleteering that Kendrick used against the church, or against, until it was settled, as often the case is, and then he, as a true and humble servant of the church, kept quiet. But I would imagine that material is, if it's available, that's the other question, would make an interesting collection sometime. He did not go as far as Dellinger, who left the church then. But Kendrick must have been a very strong holdout. And for a while, as a result, the St. Louis diocese was not in the best of reputation as far as the Vatican is concerned. In fact, I would have to say that's probably true of St. Louis as it is until recently. It has always been a liberal diocese. And the man today happens to be now on the winning side. Otherwise, you'd hear less of him. Meyer of Chicago and Richter here are the two, probably two most liberal, I should say Meyer was, and Richter is the most liberal. You can see that in both the Kansas City and in the St. Louis Roman Catholic papers. We think the St. Louis paper is radical. They tell me the Kansas City is about the most radical one of the country. Anything else? If not, we'll go into the next section now of gathering the data. Just a few preliminary words. And again, I hope that this is elementary. I hope that in many cases that it is elementary to the point where everybody knows about this, but I still haven't got to the point where I have courage enough to assume it, because if one or two of these places are still overlooked, then it would certainly be unfortunate for the poor fellow who doesn't know about this. Namely, the need to write your material, all your notes, all your data, let me put it that way, all the data on cards or small slips. I haven't seen this happen lately, but it wasn't only a few, very shortly, maybe before we had the research papers, that you'd see students at the library with a bound book, notebook, copying the bibliographical data on a sheet from library cards or what have you, with the idea that now he's got them in the book, he will look the books up later on, and then if he finds that they are good, then transfer the data onto something more flexible. Well, it's this business of avoiding the duplication. Not only that, you get yourself into such a bind if you put all the data on a single sheet or on sheets, because later on you will have to alphabetize the material, and I don't know what you do with it if you work with sheets, number one. Secondly, when you have looked at a book or periodical article and you reject it, now reject it because there's nothing in it. The temptation often is, well, then you tear up the card or the note because there's nothing in it. Only 3 or 4 months later, run across the same item again, having forgotten that you already read it or looked at it and rejected it, with great glee go to the periodical, look it up, and see, this is what I already read. This is something that happens unless you have such an extraordinary memory, it will happen to you, because the books that you have just glanced through at the beginning and rejected, most cases do not register with you, and you're simply doing the work over and over again. So the practical thing, of course, is then to use a single ply, if you can purchase those. I don't think we have in our stationery, Washington, you used to have them, cards, 4x5, 3x5, 4x6 rather, 3x5 cards, putting only one bibliographical reference on the card, putting it in the form which it'll be needed later on if you use it in your bibliography. In other words, don't put down John Robert Smith, but Smith John Robert, right away. All the data. Because while it seems a lot of waste of time, of course, to put all that material down when you know that anywhere from 20 to 30% of these titles are duds. But if you have the material, it's much quicker to put it all down and then file it later on under the rejects. But file it, so that when you run across the title, you can quickly see, I've already read it, or I've glanced at it, and it's no good. This is where you save time. I would discourage the use of small sheets, although occasionally I use them for short articles, simply because they curl up when you put them in an index box. That's the only reason. 2-ply, 3-ply cards are a little more expensive in the aggregate, and they're a little more difficult on the typewriter because they curl, you know, and you get this rat-a-tat as you type. If you had a single ply, it's sort of like paper is easier to manipulate. But if you can't get the single, the double is just as well. Try to, again, use the same size, this is up to you though, card that you use for notes as you use for bibliography. You may think you're saving a few cents to have the 3x5s on for your bibliography and the 4x6s for your notes. But then you've got two sizes to manipulate. And if you buy one of these cardboard file boxes, you can put them all in one. You don't have them rattling around and getting out of line. These are just little household hints, which frankly can be a tremendous help to you in doing a job. Then again, I don't advise using the 3x5 for notes simply because you don't get enough material on it. On the other hand, don't go to the other extreme of using, as some people do, using a half of an 8.5 by 11, the larger card. Then you get to the temptation of writing too much on it. And when a note that you have gathered out of your reading carries more than one basic idea, and that's sometimes hard to determine because you don't know where the division line is, but at least if it's very obvious to you that it's two, you may need part of the note for chapter one and part of the note for chapter five. And then you know you can't tear the thing up. You either have to lose it, run the risk of losing it, duplicating it, and then sometimes you forget to duplicate it, or make a notation under chapter two, brother, you're going to use this under five again. So if you have larger cards, there is a tendency to write too much on them, because we're all, I guess, just enough the German in us that we want to save as much money as possible and not let too much of that white space show. But again, time is more important than the price of a couple of cards. A good note card will only have one piece of data in it, just one. And as I say, sometimes this is very difficult to see. Something that's very obvious to you. For instance, it may be the man's place of birth and date and year, and that's obviously so unimportant for the moment that that's all one note. But later on, there may be, and this is maybe a rare case that I'm citing, but I just want to show you something that's been very obvious. Later on, there may be a question whether the man could have written a certain article because he was too young. And the date now becomes important, whether he was born in this decade or in the next decade. And so part of your thesis may have to discuss at least the alternate dates, even though this may not be the thing that you're going to work for a solution. And now you'll have a couple of articles or items, notes, on the one decade or the other decade. And so what started out as a very simple item gets to be a complicated thing where you will have to spend at least a couple of paragraphs in discussing it, even though a solution is not necessary for your theme. Again, as you take notes, be sure to keep track of the resources that you've used. You're going to do that with the books and the periodicals, but also your indexes, so that you don't go back to the same index scan through it, forgetting that the 1916 edition you've already gone through. So keep notes on that again. In gathering your... Yes, sir? Well, yes, I would keep a card. This is, however, a different category now. Like, you don't have to get all the data. Like International Index. Keep a card on that and check off the ones that you consulted. Just arbitrary, or if you want to, put up the whole list. That's a little time-consuming. Although, again, sometimes these time-consuming things are very simple and save time in the long run. Just like, you know, learning how to type. At first, you all just use one or two fingers. But you know you can't gain much speed that way. It'd probably be better to learn the right way. And that's the way these things are. You devise your own little mechanical aids, but later on you find that it's much slower than the better one. Now, what I'm going to get at is you can put the whole list down and then you just check them off, because you're not always going to be in a position to take them chronologically. You get down to 1913, 1914, and 1915 isn't used by somebody. Well, you're not going to sit there and twiddle your thumbs until you're through with it. You can take 16, 17, and then to check that you had 15, have to go back to it, may not be able to get at it that day, you see. Maybe next time you go to the library. So if you have them all jumbled, you can often lose one that you don't see in its chronology. This is the only reason I see of putting them in that order. And the same thing with the headings. You know, this heading thing that I talked about, putting all the different headings of all the possible subtopics under which you're going to look for books, for titles. At the bottom of that, too, you should indicate the libraries that you've consulted. So that if you have 100 headings or 50 headings, what it is, and you've exhausted the St. Louis Library and the Seminary Library, then later on you run across another very valuable subheading. Well, you know that these have been, I did these, but I'll have to go back to them because this particular topic was not considered at the time. Now, I know that some of the things I'm saying may sound less likely, but they are not less likely at the doctoral level, because there is where you ought to be getting everything, and you better look at these things in a very thorough manner. Books are normally not examined in your early stages, as I told you, because you're not always aware of what is good and what isn't good. Something which maybe the first time you saw this, and then later on you see that every ordinary textbook on the subject has the same thing. Well, it's not that important. You don't have to worry about documenting it. But if you've done your first lesson, which you mostly ought to be beyond now, if you're expecting to get your thesis this year, namely having read around in the subject, well, then I think you won't run into this risk. It's maybe wise to, at this point, to put down the library number for the book, so that it'll save you some time at a later date. Now, for the little time that is left, I'd like to have you take out your guide, and we want to spend the time on studying the bibliographical form with which you are going to deal. Now, oftentimes you then can figure out the problem yourself. We're only talking about bibliography now. We're not talking about footnotes. While in general the same data is needed, the form is different, because a footnote is what it says. It's a note. And it's all the data is stripped theoretically one note, and therefore is continuous. It has no periods, for instance. You separate the items with commas. We won't explain that at the moment. But now for bibliography, you have three major items as a minimum for every good note. The first is the author, and we use the word author in the broad sense. It may be the editor, it may be the issuing committee, the originator. The title of the part of the, that may be the title of the periodical as well as the title of the article. It could be just the title of a book, whatever, all that data. And then the mechanics of the book, the data concerning its publication. And each of these categories is separated from the other by a period. Now, in general, that's how the whole thing is worked up. I mean, this is your basic pattern. We're not going to go to all of these that are there, because this is not important. After all, you got the example. But I will try to lift out some of the exceptions. Not exceptions. There are no exceptions to this rule. But there are additional facets which you must learn about. So you can see this illustrated in the first item. And by the way, I should also indicate how this is divided into the three parts, like Gaul. This is the name of the city, where it's been published, the publisher, and the date itself. The year, of course, I should say. Those are the three parts to this. Now, because you're filing it, we naturally put it to family name first. Paul Veith becomes Veith Paul, period. Teaching for Christian Living is one single item, that's the title, and therefore is underlined throughout. And then the three items, St. Louis, : Bethany Press, the publisher, comma, copyright date, which is always the preferred date, C, period, 1929. Now I say this is, in essence, what the basic data. Strictly speaking, this does not have the same rule as a colon. You can't see it here because the break happens to be at the end of the line. There is a colon normally requires two spaces, you remember, in writing, like a period, typing. You have to have two spaces afterwards. Here it only requires one, and you can't see it in the first three examples because unfortunately they all happen to run at the end. But you do see it on the next one, C, the Lewis Sherrill one. This is, as far as I recall, the only exception to normal typing rules. And I don't know really why it is, but it happens to be one of those. Now, from then on, you begin to build. Look at B. Oh, yes, the only difference with B is when you happen to have two books by the same author in the index lineup, I mean the bibliography lineup, the second one is satisfied by five hyphens and a period. Now, obviously, on your card, you can't do that. Here, you have to write it out because you don't want you wouldn't know who this is about. But when you write it up, that's why we're doing two things really at one time. Now, the joint authors, there's really no difference, except now we separate the names, one by the family and one by the given, because we're not interested in filing this under Purcell, so we ignore that. It comes Sherrill Lewis W. There's a break, and so you put a comma, and now in the right order, the normal order, John Edward Purcell. And that's all there is. Now, you notice this one has an exception, although that isn't why it was illustrated. A fourth item has worked itself into the thing, because it has additional data. Namely, this is the revised edition. This is where it comes in between, right after the title, the revised edition, and that again is surrounded by periods. And here I have this note now, single space after colon when stating facts of publication. Otherwise, double space after colon as normal. D is merely to add the one question when somebody says, well, what do you do when you get three authors? Well, you got the example, and if you want, we don't have any four authors down. But we have the alternative to four authors in E and others, because they're usually not on the title page. Not normally, they could be occasionally, but certainly not on the spine. Or the other one is the et ali. And this, of course, being, because it's Latin, is underlined, because the word underlining a title or anything in with typing, as you know, is another way of saying it's italicized. Yes, sir?
I want to ask a question about the underlining of the title. You didn't leave a space there in the underlining, where
the
space between words. Is that on purpose?
Space between words?
Yeah, like you've got, let's take 1A, if you're teaching for a Christian living. Now, the way I would have thought the underlining is teaching, then so on. Wow.
That's right, yes. We used to have, first I'm going to say you must have an old edition. Until 2 years ago we had that too. We're trying to simplify the rules because it's going in this direction. Straight across, because it's only for nicety, yeah. The other rule. This is an easier one that you've got the thing going and you just keep on. And so we've adopted. Where we can simplify the rules, we have been trying to. So this is now the rule. The other is not wrong. It's simply that we have adopted this rule.
Yeah. Well,
always the latest copyright date. Why? Because, pardon me, I'm sorry.
I must correct that. Always the earliest. Yes. Always the earliest. Because so often the data in the book is still on the basis of the early one.
And sometimes books are reprinted, a new date, and it's not that date, does not tell the truth. It's the original date, because no changes have been made in the text or not of any importance. So that's why the copyright is the one that's important, by the way.